This is Robert from Twin Peaks, and you're listening to Inspirado Projecto.
Got a light?
Thank you so much, Rob Broski, the woodsman from Twin Peaks Season 3. What a treat for you to stop by. What we're about to listen to here, folks, is part two of my interview with Martin Schmidt, the renovator of the Golden State Theater out there in Monterey, California. He's also the king of sock monkeys. This is a title I give him, and I would really love it if everyone honored that title. He is an extraordinary sock monkey creator, enthusiast, and inventor. He shipped me a bag of these awesome magnets he made, these limited edition. I don't even know how the heck he went about making these, but I got them hanging up here on the fridge right now. We've got Sock Monkey and the Golden Banana, and he looks like a little Indiana Jones guy. We've got Sock Monkey, and it looks like the Obama poster by Shepard Fairey. Let's see, where else? I've got them all over the refrigerator. They're all over here. The Sock Father. Looks just like the Godfather poster. And what else? I think that's it. Oh, you ain't nothing but a sock monkey. That's the other one. It looks just like Elvis, little Elvis sock monkey. And then he also sent me some magnets of photography that he took of various theaters that he's been to. The Paramount Theater in Oakland, California, and up on the marquee there is Psycho, May 10th. And then Sebastian Theater in Sonoma, California. Wiltern Theater in Los Angeles, California, and up on the marquee there is Queensryche. And then the Fox Theater, Westwood Village, California, and up on the marquee there we see Red Planet. It's very, very highly creative. So we're going to get on to the second part of my interview with him. But first, we're going to hear a friendly word from our buddy Henry D. Horace and see what we can learn from him today. Thank you for listening to Inspirado Projecto.
David Lynch personally started a campaign in Hollywood to get Laura Dern an Oscar nomination for her performance in Inland Empire. He sat on the side of the road with a cow during this campaign, which was, unfortunately, unsuccessful. Stay tuned to Inspirado Projecto for more fun facts.
Welcome back to Inspirado Projecto Part 2 here with Martin Schmidt. He is going to tell us an extraordinary story, and I've got more questions for him concerning the Golden State Theater and the history of its architecture and all that is connected to it. So, Martin, what is this extraordinary story that you're going to...
Oh, okay. So, in your last episode, we were talking about the chandeliers that are hanging over the balcony in the theater.
Yes.
There's this big disc-shaped chandelier, one on either side. And those were missing from the theater for 28 years. In our last episode, I related how they divided up the theater into three auditoriums. They put two in the balcony and one downstairs in the main floor. And they did that in 1976, and the walls weren't taken down until 2004 when Warren Dewey bought the building. At the time they put the walls up, they took those two chandeliers down. I don't know really why they did. I think they maybe thought they were going to be in the way of the projectors or something, which I don't think they were. But anyhow, for whatever reason, they took them down. Maybe they just wanted to get the clutter out of there. I don't know. And they sold them. And for years, nobody knew where they were. And I knew from going up there, you could see that there would have been chandeliers because there's this big decorative plaster rosette in the ceiling where they were hanging over them. So I knew there were chandeliers there at one time, but they had long since gone missing. And then one day, several years into the restoration, my friend Gary Parks and I, whom I mentioned in the last episode, he and I were in Berkeley at an old movie theater there, much smaller than this one. I don't remember what the name of it was. Gary would remember. And we were talking to the manager of the theater, who, like us, was an aficionado of these old theaters. And it was our first time meeting him. Gary knew of him, but I don't think they'd met in person before then. So, maybe Gary knew him, but he was introducing me. It's been so long, I can't, it's like 30 years ago. The gentleman asked Kevin, I think his name was, Kevin King. And he asked me, so where are you from? I said, Monterey. And he went, oh, the Golden State Theater, yeah. He said to me, you guys are missing a couple of chandeliers from the balcony, aren't you? And Gary and I were like, yeah, how do you know about that? And he said, I know where they are. They were in storage at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, which, as I mentioned earlier, was designed by the same architects as this one. Total coincidence. Nothing to do with the story.
Brilliant.
But the man who owns that theater, his name is Alan Michon, and he is also a fan of these old theaters. And he, for a long time, I don't know if he's still doing this, but he was buying different old theaters and restoring them and using them commercially as movie theaters. Because he was a sort of real estate developer and doing other things as well. He has hands in a lot of businesses. He was also an antiquities dealer, which I think he still is. Anyway, but he was always on the lookout for old movie palace fixtures in antique stores, or flea markets, wherever he could find them, you know, estate sales, whatever. Because whenever he bought a new theater and went to refurbish it, he liked to refurbish it with period things. Even if they weren't the original ones to that theater, at least they'd look right, you know. And so when these chandeliers, I don't know how many hands they went through after they left this theater in 1976. I have no idea. But they came up for sale at some point. He found them and bought them. And remarkably, the oral history of where they had come from went with them.
Incredible.
It wasn't written down anywhere, but each owner told the next one, oh, these came from the Golden State Theater in Monterey.
Wow.
So, yeah.
They just handed down the story.
Yeah, exactly. Which is pretty remarkable, actually, because most of the times the story would be lost, separated from the artifacts themselves. So the fact that the story went with it is kind of a miracle for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the total coincidence that Gary and I happened to be in this one place, this one
brilliant.
Night, met this guy who knew where the chandeliers were, knew the history, knew Monterey.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I contacted Mr. Michon shortly after that. And I'm trying to remember when this was. This was late 1990s. I think 1998, something like that. So I contacted him when I got home, found out the phone number of the theater, and I called and got connected to him and told him who I was and what we were doing here. And at that time, this place was still owned by United Artists Theaters, and they were still showing first-run movies, which is the same thing that Mr. Michon was doing with the Grand Lake and his other theaters up in the Bay Area. He was showing first-run films. So United Artists was a competitor for him. And he scratched his head over it for a little while, and he said, well, he said, since United Artists is one of my competitors, I really don't want to, you know, enrich one of my competitors, which I can understand.
Yeah.
But he said, I'll make a deal with you. He said, if the Golden State Theater is ever sold and put in private hands, contact me, and I will sell you the chandeliers. He was as good as his word. It was years. It was, as I say, I think that conversation took place about 1998 or so. And it wasn't until 2004 that this building was sold by United Artists to a private owner. And at that time, I called Mr. Michon up, and the chandeliers were still there. He was as good as his word. And he sold the chandeliers to Warren Dewey. We took Warren's van. We went up there. He paid for them, and we brought them home and
reinstalled
them 28 years after they were removed from the theater.
Incredible.
So they're back home again. So that's quite a story, I think.
That is quite a story.
So
the fact that Universe like placed you there at that specific moment in time and the way that the dominoes fell.
And the story that went with them, which normally wouldn't happen.
And the fact that the guy said, I will not, won't give this to you now, but I will if it changes hands.
He told me in 2004 that he actually had turned down offers from several other buyers during that time that were interested in him because he knew that we wanted them.
Oh, my
gosh.
Which
was really nice of him.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So he knew. He had a feeling. He had hope for you guys that things would turn around.
So, yeah, it was a really nice favor he did for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that this community sticks together like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes it does, in the good times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always, but
So are you gonna? So now that you have the miniature of the. I'm just thinking this would be so awesome. Since you got the scale model, it could be a fun promo with your sock monkeys. Like, I'm just imagining kind of like a King Kong kind of thing. Like,
right, sock monkey they from the flagpole on top.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
You know, because you can cut it with the footage of the real Golden State Theater. Right. You know, boom, and I punch in, it's like, here come the sock monkeys.
Oh, heck, we could probably do even better than that. You know, you can get video compositors who can superimpose one scene on another and make it look seamless.
Brilliant. Right?
We could take video of the actual facade, have a giant sock monkey stomping on, climbing up the building.
Yeah, absolutely. So how's the sock monkey business going at this point?
Oh, good. Yeah, it's not really a profit-making business, but I just do it as a sideline for fun. It makes people happy.
So people just come across it on the YouTube channel? Or
it's word of mouth. You know, or sometimes I make a special one. Person may not even have thought of it, like the one I made for you.
Yeah.
You know, and send it to them as a gift. Let's see, what was the
anyone
one
who sees that sock monkey, they flip out. Like,
one I did just recently. Here, I'll show you a picture of it. I had my car was in the body shop for repairs. A lady backed into my car in a parking lot at very low speed. It just damaged my bumper, so fortunately it wasn't anything major. But I wanted to have it fixed, so. Took it into the body shop for repairs, and when I was there dropping the car off, of course we got talking with the receptionist and the estimator and so on, and for some strange reason the conversation came around to sock monkeys. I can't understand why.
Wow. Incredible.
Anyhow, but the two girls that were at the reception counter there, they were enchanted. I showed them my gallery here on Instagram.
I love it.
And they were looking through the whole thing. They loved it. And so when I went to pick the car, it was still while I was dropping the car off, that's right. I thought to myself, you know, I should really make a sock monkey for them just as a gift for the office, you know.
That's cool.
And so I did. I went online to their website, and I copied did a screenshot of their logo.
No way!
I had to trace it in my Illustrator program because it was really low resolution. So I made this T-shirt. For the monkey,
dude.
With the shop's logo on it.
Incredible.
And made the monkey and dressed him in jeans and a T-shirt. And when I went to pick the car up, I had the monkey with me in a bag. And I gave it to the estimator. It was a Saturday, so the receptionists weren't there. But the estimator that was working overtime, and he said, hey, your car's ready. And because we had this massive power failure because of the storms, you know, that week, we were without power for a couple of days where I live. And... So I didn't get his text messages on Thursday and Friday saying the car was ready. Didn't get it till the power and the phones came back on Saturday. And then I got these text messages from him. So I called him right back. And he says, yeah, come and pick it up. And he says, I'm here till 1 o'clock. So I went down there and took the sock monkey with me because I had made it. The car was in the shop for like 5 days. So it gave me enough time to make the sock monkey. And I gave it to him, and this big smile spread over his face as he pulled it out of the bag. And he says, oh, the girls will love this. And he put it right there behind the counter with my business card on it.
Oh, I love it. That's incredible.
And, so they would see it first thing when they came in on Monday.
So cool, man.
I haven't heard from them, but I did get a new follower on Instagram. I think it's one of the girls that works there.
Oh, that's great.
And she posted a picture of it on her Instagram account.
So. Oh, my God.
So yeah.
So you sew. You sew the.
Oh yeah, I sew the monkeys, the costumes from scratch.
Incredible.
I start with a pair of socks and some stuffing and a couple yards of material, whatever the material happens to be. I've created all my own patterns over the years. I've been doing this for about 20 years now. And nobody makes patterns for sock monkey clothing. A lot of people use teddy bear clothing, but the proportions aren't right because the teddy bears have little short, stumpy arms and legs, and sock monkeys are long and gangly.
Oh yeah.
So the clothes don't really fit. So I just started designing my own clothes and my own patterns from scratch, and I've refined them over the years, and every time I need to make a new garment, now I have usually an existing garment that I can start with and then just alter it, and I save all my designs on the computer so that whenever I need a pattern, I just print it out on my printer, cut it out, and you had a little paper pattern, pin it onto the material in the traditional way. And so I've got, you know, patterns for T-shirts and jeans. Here's the space suit for the astronaut.
You know what? You could probably sell those patterns on Etsy to people who want to build their own sock monkeys.
I might do that.
You could just sell those
patterns,
like $5 a pattern or something.
Something,
you know,
like
to them, that'd be totally worth it to them. They're like, oh my gosh,
and
this is great.
Yeah. It'd be a little...
It's like selling a recipe for a special, Danish or something.
I thought about it. I probably will do it one of these days. One of the drawbacks is that there are many different ways to make a sock monkey.
Mm.
You'll notice that mine don't have a neck.
True.
Right? The head and the body just sort of blend seamlessly. But a lot of people put a neck in their sock on you, which you do by sewing a little bit of thread around it and then tightening the thread to gather the sock in. Then you have a separate head and neck.
Oh.
Well, of course, since mine don't have shoulders, I use this particular pattern that accommodates that. But if you had a monkey that had a separate head and neck, he would have little shoulders. So the shirt would have to be designed differently. But what I might do, since there aren't too many variations on the basic sock monkey, there are a few. That's one of them, and there are a few others. But that's there may be three or four variations on the sock monkey. So I could make a sock monkey in each of the different styles and then start creating patterns for each of that body style and
that's
then sell
cool
those that
idea.
Way. I might do that in my copious free time.
This is great.
So this is the astronaut that I made many years ago. And his helmet there is a light globe, an acrylic globe from a light fixture.
Oh, cool.
And then on his back, you can't see it in this shot, but I have another shot that shows the back of him. And he has a life support pack on his back, which is an electrical box from the hardware store.
Oh,
plastic electrical box. And
I love the little alien, too. It's still brilliant.
I made him out of bright green socks. And
oh,
he's got little
the way you got his eyes.
Little oblong buttons there for alien eyes.
It's so great.
And then this is a pair of glasses that I made for a very dear friend of mine. She has a grandson living in the Netherlands, and he's about 10 or 11 years old right now. And he is a huge fan of the Beatles. And so she wanted to give a really special Christmas gift to him. So she commissioned me to make Beatles sock monkeys. And I don't have a picture on Instagram, but I do. I think I have a picture on another gallery, which I might be able to show you. Anyway, but so I made them and delivered them, and they're dressed like the cover of the Sgt. Pepper's album.
Oh, my gosh.
In all those satin outfits with all the different colors.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I wanted something that looked fairly iconic, and most of the time they just look like regular guys
in
suits and little narrow ties, you know. It could be anything.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the Sgt. Pepper album, so I thought, I'll make one like that. But I neglected to make, because I couldn't figure out how to do it at the time, and I ran out of time, I neglected to make glasses for John Lennon monkey. So I made these glasses a few months later, and I gave them to her, and she mailed them across the ocean to her grandson there. So John Lennon now has the glasses.
Are those is that made with a 3D printer?
Piece of coat hanger.
No way.
Yep. I took a piece of coat hanger, straightened it out, and bent with a pair of needle-nose pliers and a lot of patience.
Dude.
Into a shape for the sock monkey.
That's incredible.
Here's my Shakespeare. This is William Sockspear.
Dude, I love it.
I made that as a special gift for a friend of mine. We've known each other since we were kids, and we've done theater together for decades.
He's got his quill. It's great.
Yeah, he's got his quill pen, and his in his left hand is a little scroll with a quote from one of Shakespeare's plays. It says, "I see a voice. Now will I to the chink to spy, and I can hear my Thisbe's face." Which is a quote from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, cool. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Who says that quote?
It's one of the rustic characters. It is Nick Bottom, the weaver, who is playing the character of Pyramus in the play within a play. Because, you know, you have the half a dozen or so.
Oh, yeah,
what they call
the
rustic characters.
Oh.
And they are performing. It's a subplot within the play. There's like three different subplots that intertwine in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm.
Okay. And so the Duke of Athens is getting married. This is part of the plot of the play. And so these rustic characters, lower class tradesmen, one of them is a weaver, Nick Bottom is his name. Another one is a bellows mender, and he would be mending the bellows for the blacksmith forge and things like this. Another one is a tinker who, you know, used to make copper pots and things like that. So they're all craftsmen. But not terribly sophisticated and, you know, and then the kind of lower class in society, but good-hearted people. And they decide they want to get together and put on a play for the Duke's entertainment for the occasion of his wedding. So, and the plot of the play is basically plagiarized directly from Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, that's great.
It was okay for Shakespeare to steal from himself.
Yeah,
you know?
What a brilliant idea.
Right? And so So Francis Flute, the bellows mender, who is a boy, has to play Thisbe, which is the Juliet-type character, all right? And then Nick Bottom, the weaver, is playing Pyramus, which is the Romeo-type character. And then you have another character playing a lion who attacks Thisbe later on in the play. And then you have another character who plays a wall, the personification of a wall, which separates the, see, Pyramus and Thisbe in the play are neighbors, but they're separated by this wall between their gardens. And it's the same plot as Romeo and Juliet, basically. And their parents don't like each other, and they don't want them to see each other, and so on. And but there's a little chink in the wall, a little crack where the stones are missing, and they can talk and whisper through the wall. And so they decide that one of the characters is going to portray the wall, right? So he gets, they make him like this plasterboard costume, kind of like a sandwich sign, right? In
front of that. Great.
And he has a, let's see, so he's holding a stone in one hand, and then he holds up his fingers to represent the chink in the wall.
Oh, that's great.
That the lovers are talking through. And so Pyramus interacts with him, and what is it? I can't remember his line. Thisbe comes up and talks to the wall. She says, "Oh, wall, full often hast thou heard my moans for parting my fair Pyramus and me. My cherry lips have often kissed thy stones with lime and hair knit up in thee." And that's when Pyramus says, "I see a voice. Now will I to the chink to spy, and I can hear my Thisbe's face." He gets his words mixed up.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, it was lots of fun. And they have one. They have another character playing the moon, or the man in the moon,
oh,
actually.
Cool.
And so, yeah, this it is. And then, so they what is it? They arrange a tryst at this remote location. It's the tomb of some character named Ninus, who had died many years before. Here again, as I say, it's Romeo and Juliet all over again. And so they meet there. Thisbe gets there first, and this lion appears out of the woods, and he's just eaten some lamb or something, so his jaws are all bloody, and she screams, runs away in terror, but she drops her shawl, and the lion picks up the shawl and mangles it, gets blood all over it, and then drops the shawl and runs away. And then Pyramus comes and sees the bloody shawl.
Uh-oh.
He thinks Thisbe has been killed by the lion.
Oh my god.
So he goes to kill himself, and then Thisbe comes in. It's, as I say, it's Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's the story of
the
Shakespeare monkey. So I gave
Were you in it?
I was in the play on three different occasions, three different productions over a span of many years, playing three different characters. The first time I was a teenager and I played Peter Quince the carpenter, who is the guy who organizes the whole play.
Oh, cool.
And he's got his hands full trying to keep all the other guys focused. And and the second time I played Francis Flute, the bellows mender, who plays Thisbe. And then the third time I played, I think I played Snug the joiner, who's the one who plays the lion. And
Would
have been a furniture maker or something. So Snug the joiner is his name. And so, yeah, and this was over a period of, I don't know, 20 years maybe.
Have you been in a lot of plays?
I lost count a long time ago. I started.
Do you still do theater?
I don't have much time or energy for it anymore, but I still have contacts in the local theater scene. They all know me there.
you were in quite a few plays, huh?
I started in a children's theater classes in Carmel when I was 11 years old.
Mm.
And so that would have been in 1969. And I stayed with them through high school. And then after I graduated high school, I started working with the adult production division. It was a nonprofit children's theater, and they, excuse me, the staff of the theater, which was the director and the costumer and various other people that ran the theater, they also would produce plays with them in them as fundraisers for the children's theater nonprofit.
Mm. Okay.
They called themselves the staff players because they were the actual staff of the organization. And so I went on, after high school, I went on to work with them for quite a number of years after that in their productions. And at that point, I gravitated from actually acting in the shows to backstage work because I found that I really enjoyed that more. So I did lighting and sound and prop making and things like that.
Oh, cool. So that kind of graduated into the fact that you're able to...
Did you
do the costume design and stuff, too, for a theater? Were you in the wardrobe department?
No, I never did costume design. The costuming that I've done came along later, many years later, just out of... my own interest in,
because I imagine you're back there sewing up the Little Shop of Horrors Venus flytrap or something.
Yes, right.
Yeah, like you sewing up the tentacles or something.
No, I never did that. But there was another production group here, which is still around, And they did a production of Little Shop of Horrors one summer that I ran lights for, I think it was. So I got to watch that show. It was a joy to watch. And they, yeah, they built their own plant costume.
Oh my gosh. Because it grows.
Yeah, it grows. Well, it was like three different things. One was a little puppet in the flower pot, right? And the next one is a larger puppet. And then the giant one actually had a man inside it.
Oh my God.
And it was constructed in such a way that the plant could swallow people. And the way that worked is that the actor inside, the puppeteer, had his legs spread apart, and he would open the mouth of the plant with his arms, and then the person would dive in between his legs and get swallowed by the plant, and then he closed the mouth.
Oh my God, that's great.
And then I think they had a couple other puppeteers working the tentacles and things. It was really elaborate. And after that show closed, the very first thing the production company did was to rent the costume out to other productions.
Brilliant idea.
Yeah, so that we made money for them at the same time.
So the costume became famous, so to speak. The costume became a celebrity.
Yeah,
right, around town. It's like, I saw that costume before.
Well, actually, it went to other towns. I'm not sure exactly where. But it was, it was rented by other production companies in other cities. So it made the rounds for a number of years. Probably wore out after a while. But
what was your favorite role?
My favorite
role? Or what were some of your favorite roles?
Oh, goodness.
Were you ever in any David Mamet plays?
No, never did that. In the children's theater that I was in, it was called Children's Experimental Theater, or CET. There was actually nothing experimental about it. She just called that for tax purposes. But all our techniques were tried and proven over many years.
So we are a venue that she works with.
Go in another office.
Sorry, you guys are actually in.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, that's
so
fine.
Preferably not that way. We actually don't really have people back in that area. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're trying to find a quiet place to record, and there's a big dearth
about that,
of those.
So, sorry about that.
Where was it? Oh, yeah, so the children's theater.
Oh, interesting.
yeah, gumdrop footstools. You know, as I say, it was a nonprofit, and they didn't have a terribly large budget. The costumes were made by their resident costumer on a shoestring. Basically, she would go to garage sales and thrift stores and so forth and get various items of clothing and then alter them, add embellishments, modify them for whatever period piece we were doing. So the place survived financially by the skin of its teeth for many, many, many years. And as a result, she couldn't afford to pay royalties on scripts, right, that she would need to rent to do a production. Most other places, they go to a script rental place, and they will have to pay a certain amount of royalties, depending on, I'm not sure how the arrangement is. But she couldn't really afford to do that, so she typically wrote her own shows. Marcia Hovick was her name, by the way. And her costumer's name was Lowell Schuler, and they were fixtures here on the peninsula for decades. Anyway, so yeah, Marcia would typically write her own plays for the children to do. And this was actually an advantage because she typically wrote plays that were set in various historical periods.
Oh.
There was one about the French Revolution. It was called The Great Fear. And let's see, she would, for the younger kids, she would do fairy tales, like Grimm's fairy tales. So I remember one of the earliest plays that I was in when I played the bear in Snow White and Rose Red.
Oh.
If you know that story. And so the advantage to this was, not only did it save her money, but the kids who were in her classes, as they were rehearsing and performing these shows, they would get a part of a classical education slipped in under the radar without them realizing it.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Because they would learn some of the historical context that the
Very
play would
cool.
take place in, and or the history is of the fairy tales or whatever is the case may be. And then the older kids, once you got into high school, started doing Shakespeare and Moliere. Okay.
That's incredible.
And here again, they're both long out of the realm of copyright, so no royalties involved. But at the same time, you'd get a classical education by doing these plays.
Incredible.
I did a Moliere play one time. It was really fun. It was called The Doctor in Spite of Himself. And that was a lot of fun to do. I did several Molières. I think one of my favorite parts was actually a bit part in a Molière play called School for Wives. And this was long after I had graduated from CET and I was working with the staff players. And they did a production of School for Wives, the plot of which is that there's this old miserly guy, and he decides that he's met this young attractive woman, and he decides he wants to marry her, right? But he decides he wants to teach her how women are supposed to behave. It's very chauvinistic. So I don't remember the entire plot anymore. You'd have to look it up. But it's typical wacky Molière stuff. And, of course, the original play was in French. And so this was one of the translations. There, and you typically encounter many different translations of Molière's work. And this particular one was done all in rhyming couplets, which was pretty cool, actually. And must have been really hard to translate. But whoever had done the translation had done a masterful job. Anyway, so I was actually doing lights for the show, and I wasn't intended to be on stage at all. But partway through the run of the show, several weeks into it, the actor who played the notary, at one point the old man calls in a notary to draw up a marriage contract between him and his prospective bride. And it was just a bit part. He's only on there for one scene. But the actor who played the notary had to go out of town for some reason. I don't remember what it was, but he was going to be gone one particular weekend, which would be three shows, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And our group was so small, we didn't have understudies for anybody, you know. We just sort of winged it. And so after the news came through that he was going to have to go out of town, after one of the shows or one of the rehearsals, I forget which, we were all gathered around, sitting around in the theater, and trying to figure out how we're going to replace this guy for one weekend. Now, I had never seen a script for the show. I didn't need one because the lighting cues were very simple. It was lights up at the beginning of the scene, lights down at the end of the scene. You know, so I didn't really need a script. I could just wing it. And but I had seen several performances by that point. Probably, I think, six or eight or performances at least. And the way my memory works, if I hear something repetitively, it tends to stick in my memory. Okay, so I knew his entire part.
No way.
Without ever having seen a script.
Incredible.
So we're all sitting around. Marcia had directed the show, and she's trying to figure out who she's going to get, and they're all talking amongst themselves. I'm just kind of sitting in the background. And she said, well, who are we going to get to replace him? And I said, piped up, I said, Marcia, I can do the part. And she said, oh, well, Lowell, do you think you could fit a costume for him? Because I'm much taller than most people. And Lowell looked me up and down. She says, yeah, I got some things I can cobble together. We'll make it work. And Marcia said, well, we need to find him a script. Does anybody and everybody else hung under the scripts very jealously because, you know, they wanted to refresh their memories periodically so they keep the part fresh. And nobody could spare a script. Marcia said, well, I said, Marcia, I don't need a script. I know the part, but she just didn't listen, and she was asking all these, well, can we get a script from here? Do we have one in the office? People look in the office. I said, Marcia, I finally put my foot down. I said, I don't need a script. I know the part. She didn't believe me, so I turned to the actor that I was going to be playing opposite, and I said, give me my cue. And he did, and we ran through the entire scene right then and there.
Dude.
Word perfect.
You're like, give me my cue.
And at the end of the scene, I turned to Marcia, and she was sitting there with her mouth open.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
She said, well, I guess you don't need a script. Okay.
That's great.
So I did that part for that weekend.
Incredible.
And it was total blast to do because I threw everything in the kitchen sink.
I bet. Because you're just like, okay, I just got this weekend.
Yeah.
I'm just going to really go for it.
Yeah, let it rip. And so I made him this little nearsighted character, or kind of hunched over, right? And I think I had a little pince-nez glasses or something. And so I was kind of squinting and blinking all the time because he was nearsighted. And I gave him this squeaky voice, and let's see what else. Oh, yeah, and I had a sheaf of papers because I was a notary, of course, and drawing up marriage contracts and various other legal documents, and a big black quill pen, like a big crow feather or something. Didn't actually have a pen.
Oh, having props are the best. I love it.
And yeah, I could wave it in his face and whatever. Yeah. It was wonderful. So, come the first performance, so what I would do is. Since there wasn't any backstage connection between the light booth and the dressing rooms, I would get, before the house opened, I would get in costume and makeup, and I would go and sit up in the light booth before the house opened and sit there during the entire show. And then
in your costume and makeup?
In costume and makeup.
Ready to rock, right.
Run
down.
Then, yeah, and there weren't any light cues during my scene.
Perfect.
So when the scene started, when the scene was about to start, I would walk down out of the light booth, cross through the lobby, and go backstage and be ready to enter, right? And then I'd walk on, do the part, and then walk off and walk back through the lobby, back up the light booth, get ready for the next light.
Wow.
So it was a cool exercise in versatility. But so that first night, I come on stage, and I'm like, oh, there you are, sir. I am the notary. So there's a contract which you'd have me draw. And he says, how shall I do it? He's muttering to himself this whole time. This is one of those scenes where he's talking to himself, and I think he's talking to me.
Oh,
all right, so I'm responding to him, and he's just muttering to himself.
That's great.
So I said, there's a contract which you'd have me draw? And he says, how shall I do it? And I said, according to the law. And he goes, I must be prudent and think what course is best. And I say, I shall do nothing against your interest. And so we ran through the whole scene, and what happens is I'm following him around the stage, thinking that I'm talking to him, and he's just talking to himself, right? And finally, he turns around and bumps into me, and then he gets really agitated that this fool has been trailing him around. He doesn't realize that I'm the notary, that he's actually summoned to be there.
Oh, my God, that's great.
So he gets really agitated and pushes me down onto a bench. I can't remember the whole part anymore, but... So, yeah, he turns around and bumps into me, and I'm rattling on about legalities and things like this. And he's saying, oh, what are you doing? What are you in my way for? And he says, when I have need of you, I'll send word. Until then, stop blathering, you blatherskite. And he sits me down, and he storms off the stage. And I was supposed to turn to the audience and say, he's mad, I judge, and I think my judgment's right. And then his two servants come in, and I say to them, your master sent you to fetch me, isn't that so? And they go, yes. And I say, how you feel about him, I don't know, but I regard him as a senseless boor. Tell him I said so. And I stormed off. It was such a fun part to do.
It's great. Amazing. You remember all these lines. It's crazy.
That's the way my memory works. It's something I've been blessed with over the years. But the thing was that it was something totally unexpected to happen during that first performance. When he sat me down on the bench, he puts his hands on my shoulders and pushes me down on the bench. And I didn't realize it, but his sleeve, he had his big sleeve, and his sleeve caught my big black feather pen and snapped it in half.
Oh!
So it was just kind of hanging the way up there. And I didn't realize it. And what the bit of business that I had come up with was, and we did this all through rehearsals, as he stormed off, I would throw the pen at him. And, of course, it would just sort of go fuff, 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 through the air and fall on the floor. It wouldn't actually hit him. But it was this expression of rage. And so I did that. He sits me down. I didn't realize it, but the feather broke. I threw it at him. Fuff, 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 it falls on the floor. And I turned to the audience and delivered my line. He's mad, I judge, and I think my judgment's right. And then I would go upstage and pick up the feather. And when I picked it up, I saw that it was broken. And I turned around to the audience. It was this perfect ad-lib moment. Turn around to the audience, holding it in front of me with this expression of utter sorrow on my face that my favorite quill had been broken.
It's great.
It was just so totally extemporaneous.
I love that.
And the audience just broke up. And
those are those improvisational moments that the audience really loves, because you roll with it.
And
you
knew it wasn't supposed to happen that way, but you roll with it, and it makes it even better. And then his servants come on, and I worked myself into a lather over the, and then stormed off, looking at this bed like, oh, man, this is my favorite quilt. And the audience just burst out into a round of applause as I walked up.
Oh, that's great.
And all my fellow actors who were in the play, the ones who weren't on the stage at that time, I didn't realize this, but they had all gathered backstage, and they were watching me through the wings, and they gave me an ovation as well as I walked.
That's great.
So I think that has to be one of my proudest moments
in theater. Oh, my God. I could totally see why. That's incredible, man.
Yeah. Wow, it's a fun memory.
Listen, Martin, I have to get up there for the sound check. But, dude, time flew with us talking, man. Thank you so much taking me up, showing me up here again and giving me all that information. I was so happy to hear about your theatrical past, because I have a whole theater past too. And just hearing people's joy of acting on stage and, you know, being in those ensemble moments and improvisation, of course. I love improv.
Yeah. And I'm glad I got to share you some of the little nuances, the little details.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for that. People's notice. Oh, I was going to show you one other thing too.
Oh yeah.
This place was built in a great hurry in only 1 year.
And oh my gosh!
I talked to a gentleman. He's no longer with us, but he was one of the last. He was the last surviving construction worker who built this place. His name was Ed Brooks, and he told me how much of a hurry they were in when they built this place. He was finishing the stair railings on the afternoon before opening night.
Oh,
yeah. He said the foreman that day, it was August 6th, 1926. He said, "Ed, come over here. You got to finish these stair railings by 5 o'clock." And he looked at him, and it needed a lot of work. And he said he worked like mad to finish all the stair railings in the lobby by 5 o'clock.
Oh.
He said at 5 o'clock, he went home, changed his coat, came back for the opening night show.
Oh, my gosh.
But the thing was, I didn't realize this for many years, but there were a couple of details they forgot to install.
Oh, my gosh.
And these were one of them. These four things right here
really were
missing. They had never
No
been
way.
You can see there's four more on the other side.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? But these are little, I don't know what you'd call them, little ornament things. Over this, for the benefit of your listeners, we're standing in one of the entrances to the balcony. There's this archway over my head. And these ornaments sort of anchor the bottom of the archway.
Yeah, on either side of the, where you see the exit sign, you'll see how these things kind of come down. They're almost like little, I don't know, like ledges of some sort or something.
Cornices, I think you'd call them.
Cornices.
Anyway, so yeah, I found a spare one up in the storeroom on the third floor. But there was only one of them, and these archways just sort of ended without these ornaments on them.
Oh my gosh.
And so, unfortunately, the spare one that I had found disappeared. One of the theater ushers took it home, I guess. But there was another one on the other side, which was becoming detached from the wall just due to age and use. People would bump into it and so on. So with the manager's permission, here again, this is during United Artists days, I clipped the wires that were holding it onto the wall, took it down, took it home. The corners were all broken, and there were big dings and chips in it, so I repaired all that with modeling clay.
Oh, cool. Okay?
Made a urethane mold, like a rubber mold from it.
Whoa.
And cast these four replacements. So this is my work.
Incredible.
So I cast these four replacements for it, and a friend
Incredible.
And I installed them here on the wall and painted them to match. So
that is brilliant.
That is my work right there.
That is cool.
So
you have so many contributions to this extraordinary place, man. This place is great.
Well, as I say, I grew up going to movies here. This was the most magical building I'd ever seen. I've been in love with it since I was a little kid. And I'm 65 now, so that's a good many years worth of water under that bridge.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
cool that you've been able to, like...
We go way back. This
stamp,
building,
you know, put your stamp into this
I've
place.
I've wanted to restore it ever since 1976.
Wow, man.
When they put the walls up in the balcony, the first time I came in and I saw it, I thought what a tragedy it was. They had to do it to the beautiful old place.
Oh, my
and
God.
That was the day in 1976 when I first thought, gee, it would be nice to restore this place.
Oh, my God.
The idea stayed in the back of my mind until the late 1980s when I finally had an opportunity to start working on it.
God, that is so exciting.
And I spent 15 years actively hands-on. All this paint in the lobby, this is all my work.
Oh,
well,
my
volunteers. I can't take all the credit for it. My volunteers did a lot of it, most of it. But this, the auditorium and the lobby were spray-painted in the 50s, plain white. And all this gorgeous ornamentation was painted over. Gosh. If you can imagine, this whole place, just white. It looked like a mausoleum. But that was the only view of it I had ever known, because it was done before I was born. But then when I started collecting old photographs of it, which I have a small collection of old photographs at home, they were black and white, but you could see where there was gold and different shades of gray, which indicated different colors. So with the permission of United Artists, some volunteers and I went up and scraped paint in strategic spots to find out what the colors were underneath. We took paint chips from the hardware store and matched the paint.
Oh, man.
And what we have to do is match it under this specific lighting, because otherwise if you take a chip of paint under a different light, try to match it there, it won't match here. So we got a bunch of paint chips, and we held them up until we found the correct colors. And we went. And the manager paid for the paint out of his own pocket, bless his heart.
Oh, my gosh. Because
he didn't have a maintenance budget for it. And we started repainting all this gold and ornamentation, all the colors. That's all our work.
Wow, that is incredible.
We started at one end of the lobby and worked our way down over a period of several weeks to the other end. Then we went upstairs and worked our way back.
Wow.
It took several months in our spare time. But we brought it back to its original look.
That
so
is
what
fantastic.
You see here today is what it looked like originally.
Wow, man.
So, yeah, you got the blue in the coffered ceiling up there, and you've got all these heraldic shields all over in various designs.
Yeah.
They're painted red and green and gold, and it's all the original colors and the original patterns are very painstakingly reconstructed. Over here you've got, this is a cool little detail. These windows into the auditorium are what were known as crying windows, because if you had a baby that was crying and you didn't want to interrupt the show, you could get up. Of course, remember,
Brilliant idea.
Silent film days, so you weren't missing any dialogue. You could come up, take your baby, and stand here at these windows and look through at the show, and you wouldn't miss anything.
Incredible.
And your baby wouldn't disturb the people inside.
Incredible.
So you see this beautiful ornamentation all around.
Yeah.
Down here at the bottom, there's the three graces.
Whoa.
From classical mythology, I guess it is.
Wow.
And yeah, you can see they're all sculpted in the plaster there.
Dude. That is cool.
So, yeah.
Crying window.
This gold is all spray paint.
Mmm.
Because we couldn't find a brush on paint that was bright enough to show properly under this reduced lighting.
Oh.
So we had to use spray paint, which meant everything we painted had to be masked with newspaper and masking tape. Everything that was painted gold. This window, with all these little nooks and crannies, took 3 hours to mask.
Oh my gosh.
And then we sprayed it in 10 minutes and then pulled all the masking down.
Incredible.
But, yeah.
Wow.
But I am so fortunate to have had the opportunities that I've had and to get the volunteers that I had.
Yeah.
And to have developed the relationship with United Artists that I did. Because they were a little nervous about meeting us originally. Because they have, United Artists is, I guess they're still around, I don't know. But they were a huge movie theater chain. They had theaters in many, many cities. And they had a few other old properties like this one in other cities. And they had had preservationists approach them in other cities. And those preservationists often took a sort of antagonistic approach, right? Like, we're going to tell you what you can and cannot do with your building. And I learned about that, I realized that is not the way to approach someone like this if you want to really accomplish something.
Yeah.
So I had a small collection of old photographs by this time that I had gotten from a local photo archive. And so I introduced myself to the theater manager, told him who we were and a small group of volunteers and what we wanted to do, and showed him the photographs. And he called up, not necessarily the same day, but we came back, a few days later, and he had called up his superiors in Fresno in the district office, and they came out here, and I reiterated my same pitch to them. I says, we're not here to tell you what to do with the building. We just want to bring it back to the glory that it used to have so that people will enjoy it and appreciate it again. And I must have made a favorable impression because they allowed us to go ahead with the work. And we were also allowed to install the pipe organ. The original organ had been removed in the 50s. So the chambers were empty, and we installed this one ourselves. Took almost 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
In our spare time on weekends. And this was the only time, the first and so far as I know, only time that volunteers had installed an organ in one of UA's old theaters. So that was, bit of a feather in our caps. But we went through a succession of several managers while we were working on this, as you might expect. You know, people get promoted and somebody else comes in. And one of the managers who was really, really the one of the best friends we ever had, his name was Brad Johnson. And it was such a joy working with him. He was very strict and businesslike, but he did a lot of favors for us because we did a lot of favors for him. Mm. And he was the one that paid for the paint and all the rest of the stuff that we did.
Wow. You just had such a cooperative group of people helping put this thing together. Yeah. And it's great that they all appreciated it and they saw the value in what you were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was very fortunate that way. And so eventually he became successful enough that they promoted him. I was really happy for him and his family. He got promoted up to a much larger theater in the East Bay, San Francisco area. And of course, the way the compensation structure worked, the bigger your theater, the more you got paid.
Oh, okay. Right?
Which is good because it will work for you. So it was a big step up the career ladder for him. I was so happy for him and his family, but at the same time, we were so sorry to lose him from Monterey because he had done so many good things for us.
Wow.
So yeah, Brad Johnson, super guy. I hope he's still very successful wherever he is and whatever he's doing now. And this was 20 plus years ago, and so I don't know what he's doing now. I haven't been in contact with him, but.
Dude, well, Martin, thank you so much for
telling me. My pleasure. Well, thank you for your time.
All this great stuff. This is so exciting.
And all my rambling stories.
No, this is perfect. And, I cannot wait to share this with the listeners. I mean, this is just going to be great.
Wow. That interview is from 3/17/2023 at the Golden State Theater. Yet once again, I have to remind you of that. What an insightful conversation we had there with Martin. Very insightful. I love talking to people who have such deep interests, go down the rabbit holes, do all of the deep dives, searching through the archives, investigating the yesteryear. It makes a location so much more rich. Just fascinating. Just absolutely fascinating. Thank you for sticking around for part two of this. I have no doubt that the next time we play at the Monterey Golden State Theater, I will be interviewing Martin again about a whole wide variety of other things, in addition to most likely more history about the Golden State Theater. I'm sure we could go through that place piece by piece, and he's got a fun story about what he and his team had done to put that together. Next up, we got a very fun message from Man Behind the Machine. Let's check that out and see what is in store.
Danger zone.
Danger zone. Gonna take Danger zone. To the
Off.
Danger zone.
Danger zone. No, just three times. Danger zone. Danger zone. Danger zone.
The danger zone. Inspirato Projecto Radio. This is Man and Mr. Man Behind the Machine. Right, Man? Say hi, Mr. Man. Say hi, Mr. Inspirato. Hi.
Exemplary. Exemplary.
Ow!
Ow! The crowd is going wild.
Ow!
Exemplary rendition of Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins. Extraordinary. We play that song at Yachtly Crew. Which, by the way, just to let y'all know, that interview with Martin Schmidt took place at the Golden State Theater because Yachtly Crew was playing there on 3/17/2023. During the Yachtly Crew shows, we play Danger Zone halfway through, and I'm not going to tell you what happens. You're going to have to see the show to see what's going on there. But my goodness, Man Behind the Machine, thank you so much for adding voice message and letting Mr. Man
just let loose? I think if when it came time for part two, for Top Gun part two to come out, if they would have known that this song existed, they would have completely put it right there in the opening credits. I just know it. So thank you so much. By the way, folks, if you have not listened to Man Behind the Machine podcast, check that out. It's very insightful. Man Behind the Machine. Very good stuff. And now I'm going to leave you with this little giblet from my brother, Pauly Shores. I play the character Stony Shores in Yachtly Crew. This is from my brother, from another mother, or from the same Yachtly Crew mother, the mother of Yacht Rock. His name is Pauly Shores. He's the sexy sax man. And go ahead, Pauly.
Take it away.
Inspirato. Projecto. Inspirato. 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 Inspirato.